ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय माधुकार महासर्प लोकेस्मिन्नो गुरुत्तमो वैराग्यं परितोषं च प्राप्तयाश्चिक्षया वयम्।
The bee and the python are two excellent spiritual masters who give us exemplary instructions regarding how to be satisfied by collecting only a little and how to stay in one place and not move.
Virag sarva kamebhya
शिक्षितो मे मधुव्रतात्
त्रिश्चाप्तं मधुवाद्वित्तम् हत्वाप्यन्यो हरेत्पतिम्।
From the bumblebee I have learned to be unattached to the accumulating of money, for although money is as good as honey, anyone can kill its owner and take it away. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The honey gathered in the comb can be taken away by force. Therefore, one who accumulates money should realize that he may be harassed by the government or by thieves or even killed by enemies, especially in this age of Kali Yuga. It is said that instead of protecting the money of the citizens, the government itself would take away the money with the force of law. The learned Brahman had therefore decided that he should not accumulate any money. One should own as much as he immediately needs. There is no need to keep a big balance at hand, along with the fear that it may be plundered by the government or by thieves. I will read from the last few translations. In this human form of life, a man and woman unite for sensual pleasure of sin. The Brahman continued, I am actually seeing how a rich man who is a victim of his senses is very greedy to accumulate wealth and therefore suffers from insomnia due to fear from all sides, despite his wealth and opulence. Those who are considered materially powerful and rich are always full of anxieties because of government laws, thieves and rogues, enemies, family members, animals, birds, persons seeking charity, the inevitable time factor, and even their own selves. Thus they are invariably afraid. Those in human society who are intelligent should give up the original cause of lamentation, illusion, fear, anger, attachment, poverty, and unnecessary labor. The original cause of all these is the desire for unnecessary prestige and money. The bee and the python are excellent spiritual masters who give us exemplary instructions regarding how to be satisfied by collecting only a little and how to stay in one place and not move. From the bumblebee I have learned to be unattached to accumulating money, for although money is as good as honey, anyone can kill its owner and take it away. An acharya is one who practices what he preaches. The Avadhuta Brahman is a clear example. He is explaining to us the great necessity for vairagya, or renunciation, within our life. And he is living as a personal example to the highest degree of this principle. Here, he is showing how Krishna reveals truth through the agency of this material nature. Factually, at every moment of the day, there is a great lesson unfolding before us. But we can only understand that message if we open our hearts with humility to see how Krishna is arranging everything for everyone's ultimate benefit. How everything is taking place in this world is most instructive. Krishna does not do anything whimsical. And everything is working under his direction. Therefore, everything that takes place everywhere and at every moment has a very, very specific divine purpose. And Krishna consciousness means to try to understand this divine purpose. And material consciousness means to be dull-headed, to simply see things from the superficial point of view and think that things are happening by accident or by chance, or there's no real meaning or cause behind what is taking place in our lives. Or we become philosophical and try to speculate and concoct what everything means that is taking place around us. But as described in the Shastra, that a learned and intelligent man sees through his ears. By hearing from the Shastra, by hearing from the Guru, and by hearing from the Sadhu, we are given the vision by which we can understand how this world is going on and why, and how it affects us personally and directly. Without the association of such great souls, the mysteries of Krishna's divine instructions are never revealed to us. Even when Krishna directly and personally speaks, without the help of the spiritual master and the great souls, we cannot understand what is being said. That is why it is said, Tad vijnanartham sugurum eva abhigacchet, that one cannot understand the Vedas without the help of a spiritual master. It is said by Krishna in Gita, Tad vidhi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya upadekshantite jnanam jnaninastvatadarshanam. That if you want to know the truth about anything, you have to approach the spiritual master, inquire submissively, and be his servant. If you are not willing to do that, in other words, the total mood of a disciple is submissiveness and humility. To the degree you're humble and submissive, to that degree knowledge can be revealed to you. To the degree you're not, to that degree you can have the greatest spiritual master, but you will not understand anything. You see, there's a qualification of a guru and there's a qualification of the disciple. The guru must be self-realized. He must be repeating what he has heard from the previous authorities, and he must practice. Such a person can impart the truth. But unless you are a bona fide disciple, even if you have the greatest, most most self-realized spiritual master, you will not understand anything. And the qualifications of the disciple all have to do with submissiveness and humility. Krishna said you must inquire submissively and render service. That means you have to become, to the degree you are the obedient, humble servant, to the degree you are freed of any sense of false prestige, to the degree you consider all of your previous learning and all your previous talents to be so many zeros, having no meaning, to that degree you can hear. To the degree you think you're great, to the degree you think you're learned, to the degree you think that you know what is what, to that degree you cannot hear. You are creating a barrier, a dam between the river of nectar that's flowing from the mouth of Krishna through his devotees and your heart. So therefore, one must learn to see through submissive hearing. By submissively hearing from the great authorities, we can understand how Krishna is arranging and orchestrating everything within this world according to his mercy for us individually as well as for all living beings collectively. We have to give up our speculation, our concoction of what we like, what is good, what we think God should do, and what he shouldn't do. The other night at the car center, someone was very seriously inquiring that it's since the Mahabharata's last few shows of the television series, so many people are criticizing Lord Krishna, thinking that he's a political man. Of course, I have not seen this series in some time. And they're thinking that Krishna is just, why is Krishna being political? He should not be like this. He should be like we want him to be. He shouldn't be the way he thinks he should be. He should be like we think he should be, and we don't think he should be in getting involved in these political affairs. So therefore, there's something wrong. Now, who are we to judge God, who happens to be the supreme controller of all controllers, the source of everything, the cause of all causes? Who are we with our tiny little infinitesimal brains and our conditioned senses to evaluate how God could best manage his universal affairs? We simply have to inquire submissively how Krishna is supreme and why he is doing like he is doing. It may be inconceivable to us, but we must accept ultimately that he is the supreme controller and we are always under his control. He is the master, we are the servant, and everything he does is all good. Everything he does is all perfect. And everything that is taking place under his direction is all perfect. And it just so happens that everything is taking place under his direction. So therefore, Om Purnam Adha Purnam Idam Purnat Purnam Udachyate, everything is all perfect. But due to the bodily conception of life, due to trying to accumulate more and more and more wealth and prestige in this world, as a process of gaining greater and greater forms of sense gratification, through this process we become bewildered and we cannot perceive the all-perfect arrangement of God in anything or anywhere. Therefore, Krishna is so wonderful that at every step of material nature, he's simply instructing the spirit soul to give up his illusory struggle for sense enjoyment and surrender to him. If you simply hear submissively and apply what you have heard to your vision of life, you will see in every instant, whether you're in the city, whether you're in the country, every sound, every action that's taking place is reminding you to surrender to Krishna, reminding you that this material world is not a place of happiness. Therefore, such a great soul He may have one guru, but he hears his guru speaking and sees his guru working through everything in this existence. And that is a fact. Krishna is Jagat Guru. And he is speaking through the spiritual master to instruct us. But that same Jagat Guru who's speaking through our spiritual master is speaking through everything, everywhere. And if we simply hear the words of our guru submissively and look for the confirmation of his instructions in everything, you will find the confirmation of everything he says at every second of your life. Actually, life is most exciting. It's most dynamic and adventurous when you have this vision. When you're always looking to see what Krishna's trying to tell you for confirmations of his divine instructions and the divine instructions of his guru in everything. You become very philosophical. Everything that comes upon in your life, you see in a very philosophical light. And it only increases your faith and increases your conviction and your devotion. And this is the way devotees are supposed to see. We're supposed to see Krishna everywhere and in everything. We're supposed to hear his voice everywhere and in everything. And it's possible if you're just a little humble and you're looking for Krishna in everything and everywhere. When people come to abuse you, one way to respond is just, why is he abusing me? I'm actually a very nice person, and he's not speaking the truth, and this is all nonsense, and I'm leaving this place. Huh? Or we could see how, Krishna, what is he trying to tell me through this person? He has some special plan. This is not just an accident. Krishna's the doer. This person, whatever his motive is, that doesn't make that's between him and God. All I know is God is using him as an instrument of love to teach me something. Now, what am I supposed to learn here? Huh? If you approach it like that, you know how much you'll learn in that situation? You'll learn infinitely. When you're put in a predicament where you can't see you, where you're just inevitably struggling, striving, and failing, one way to see it is, why is God doing like this? I tried so hard. I'm trying to please my Guru Maharaj. This is not. I give up. This is not the way it should be. Or maybe I'm just so useless. I just give up. But a devotee should see that the circumstance is superficial. The circumstance we're not so concerned with, it's all temporary. But what is the essence of the circumstance? The essence of the circumstance is that Krishna is the supreme controller and he's somehow or other orchestrating things just like this to teach me something out of love. And if we see that and we calculate what is my Guru Maharaj teaching me and what am I to learn according to his instructions in this situation, you will learn. Your realizations will grow deeper. You will see the perfection of the all perfect. Of course, at the same time, when everything is going just the way you like it, instead of becoming proud and prestigious, thinking, just see how great I am, everyone, just watch what I can do. We should philosophically see that Krishna is the supreme controller. Somehow or other, as unqualified as I am, he's allowing this to be right. How is this possible? What does he want to teach me? Maybe he wants me to evaluate how to see how my ego is going crazy as soon as I get a little success. He's testing me. He has an instruction to reveal to me. This is a fact. Every incident of life is a learning experience that is lovingly being taught by Krishna. and it can be understood only by hearing submissively from the sadhus. Then we see through our ears. So here, the great Abhidhuta is describing what he has learned from the bee and the python. Now, the bee is such an insignificant creature. How many times a day do people in this world see bees? Huh? Every day, billions of people in this world see bees fly by. Huh? And what do they think? They don't think anything. They think, they just don't even notice it. Or, at the most, they think, oh, I hope he doesn't sting me. Huh? Something like that. But here, this great Brahman, Abhidhuta, he's describing that he learned everything about life just from watching a bee. He learned everything about material existence. The moral of the story to the entire material world he learned by simply examining a bee. Try to understand this whole society. If they would just understand what the bee is telling them, there would be no longer any anxiety, there would be no longer any violence, there would be peace on earth. If they would just listen to the message of the bee that Krishna is speaking through. Everyone in this world is mad to accumulate prestige and wealth. And factually, that the whole world is going around on that basis. Profit, adoration, and distinction. It is called by Srila Prabhupada subtle sex life. That is the motivating force behind everyone everywhere in this human society. The wars in this world, even the religious wars, so-called, they are not based on any religious principles. They're simply based on the desire, the greed for prestige and wealth. Of all wealth, the greatest form of wealth is land. So nations are fighting one another, conquering one another, building bombs every day, spending billions of dollars building nuclear weapons, simply because they want to defend and procure more and more land, which is wealth. And through the process, they attain great prestige. And through this false ego, they can think more and more that they are the lord of all they survey, that they are the enjoyer. That is on a large level. On a smaller level, people are simply struggling hard, enduring so many sacrifices, enduring so many pains and sufferings, implicating themselves in so much pious and sinful karma. For what purpose? For wealth and prestige. Men are hungry, they're mad, they're greedy for wealth and prestige. Even pious people are mad for prestige. In this way, we can calculate, if we study practically any ordinary person in this world, we'll find that that is the state of their consciousness. When you go to college or school, all you are taught is the great glory of wealth and prestige. And how you should sacrifice so much to study so that you can acquire more wealth and prestige in your future life. And that's all there is to it. So the bee, which is such an insignificant little creature, hardly 1 inch in size, one single bee can give you all the information you need to immune yourself from this whole dilemma of the spell that all living entities, from the greatest scholars to the greatest heroes throughout history, they are all under the spell of the same energy. And if they would just listen to the bee, they would become liberated. Because the bee is teaching by his example the condition of whole human society and its futility. The bee is out collecting all day the pollen. He is working so hard. And then he takes that and transforms it into honey. And he puts it in his honeycomb. He puts it in the honeycomb. And the bees are working together as an entire civilization, individually, collectively, just accumulating more and more and more and more honey. Have you ever seen the size of beehives? Sometimes beehives are 10 feet big and 6 feet wide. And bees are just working all day, practically all day and all night, just going out and accumulating little particles of pollen, working hard, transforming them to honey, and packing them very nicely. A honeycomb is a very, very scientifically designed apparatus to protect the honey and to keep it fresh. And man has never, in all his years, been able to perfect such a container for honey in his life as the bee has perfected. They create wax. They seal perfectly uniform little compartments, and they seal it on all sides with wax, and it stays very fresh and very pure. And they're working so hard, collecting, 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 more and more. And they're all thinking the future, their happiness, their welfare, for themselves, for their families, for future generations. And then what happens? The beekeeper comes, just shoos all the bees away, takes all the honey away, and sells it. And the whole bee's life of work, within a moment, is all taken away. The bee takes such pleasure in drinking that honey. It's the nectar of his life, and it's just all gone. Here, it is described that money is like honey. Money is like honey because it is very sweet. Because it is through the agency of money that all forms of sense gratification are available to us. And there is nothing sweeter than sense gratification. And the means to sense gratification is facilitated by money. So money is honey. But it is the same type of honey as the honey is to the bee. You work so hard accumulating. You work so hard throughout your life simply to accumulate more and more funds, more and more prestige. Not knowing that today or tomorrow, everything you've done is simply going to be taken away. And it is described in Kali Yuga, it's so evident. At death, you know everything's going to be taken away. But during our life, we try to protect it as far as possible. And the whole purpose of a government is to protect the innocent from the rogues and thieves. In Sanskrit, the administrators who were protecting the citizens were called kshatriyas. Kshatriya literally means one who protects from harm, one who protects one from pain. Now, the greatest pain is when you are attached to something and it's taken away. There is no pain more severe than that. To lose something that you are attached to lose something you have great affection for. is horribly painful. So the kshatriyas are meant, their whole purpose in society is those innocent people, to protect them from the rogues and thieves who are trying to take away from them, trying to take their lives, trying to take their wealth, trying to take their prestige. But in Kali Yuga, the very people that are supposed to protect you are the greatest, most expert, and most ruthless thieves. You work so hard, and you're thinking the government will protect you from burglars coming in your house, from people coming and taking away your estate. But the government themselves, through their laws, they come right into your house and they steal most all of your income and most all of your everything. Huh? It is described in Srimad Bhagavatam that taxation will become so severe that by the end of Kali Yuga, actually, just by the in the progress of Kali Yuga, people will become so fearful of the government and consider the government as such plunderers, rogues, and thieves that they will be running into the forests to live in the wilderness just to escape from the people who are supposed to be protecting them because of their heavy laws for taxation. And this is happening today. Of course, in India, when the Mughal rule was here, some of the more notorious of the emperors, if you were not of their religion, they would put such heavy tax on you that you would be forced to go to jail. You would lose everything. And this is the way they converted so many millions of people to their religion, through taxation. These are the people that are supposed to be protecting us. And it's going to get worse and worse and worse. Sometimes there's a little sense of relief in the middle of it all. But we can understand right now people are so positive and so encouraged that, they're tearing down the Berlin Wall and Romania is having free elections and Czechoslovakia is having elections and all these places and Russia is open to so much free enterprise that the world is becoming very nice and the governments of the world are becoming very liberal. And it is true that there's sometimes when you're suffering a horrible disease, sometimes there's some moments where you feel good. Huh? So at this particular time, it appears that yes, things are very nice, but don't think that they're going to keep getting better. We have to see things through our ears. And in our ears, it is explaining that this is the age of Kali Yuga, and things will become more and more and more and more degraded. And the most vehement and demoniac of all the agencies of Maya in Kali Yuga will be the governments, exploiting the people like anything, becoming the worst enemies of the people in general. Whether you call it capitalism, communism, or socialism, these are all just so many names. But the ideal behind all of them is exploitation for sense gratification. And therefore, although it is explained that there is a period of a golden age within Kali Yuga, by the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this golden age will only really take effect when people take to religious life and chant the holy names of God. That is the only possible way of immuning yourself from the influence of Kali Yuga. So just as the beekeeper simply feeds the bees more and more and more just to get them to make more and more and more honey, knowing that in due course of time he's just going to take it all away. So Maya is like a big beekeeper She has a whole civilization of bees just swarming around, working like madmen to accumulate more and more of the honey of wealth and money, knowing that she's just going to take it all away in due course of time. So from the most insignificant little bee, how much we can learn about life. And the python, he's giving the example, how the python is just sitting in one place. He's just the opposite of the bee. He's just sitting in one place, and everything's being provided for him. He doesn't have to do anything. Because he's willing to live a simple life, because he's not concerned with all kinds of extraneous luxuries in life, he can live very peaceful. To the degree we become attached to elaborate living conditions, to that degree we're in anxiety and we're in fear. There's such fear. But the python has nothing to fear. Why? Because he has nothing to lose. If you have nothing to lose, you have nothing to fear. So why doesn't everyone just become like a sannyasi and live in the jungles? That is not required. You see, this principle of having nothing to lose means nothing to fear doesn't mean you have to give up everything you have. You have to give up the self, the false sense of proprietorship. Even if you are a very, very wealthy person with a very prestigious position, if you understand clearly through hearing from the great sadhus that nothing is mine, it all belongs to Krishna. It's all his property. It's all his energy. Then even though you may have millions and millions, you have nothing to lose because you're not claiming anything to be yours. And if you have nothing to lose, you have nothing to fear. You see, the python is someone who is simply detached from anything for himself. Therefore, he's willing to live the simplest life, a very peaceful and fearless life. Srila Prabhupada said to us, he said, a saintly person is not attached to living in a palace if Krishna wants him to live under a tree. And he's not attached to living under a tree if Krishna wants him to live in a palace. He's only attached to Krishna. If Krishna wants you to live in a palace, then you should think, this palace is not mine, this palace is God's. Whatever prestige is given me, it's all his. Everything is his, Sarva Loka Maheshwaram. Nothing is mine. So if nothing is mine, there's nothing that can be taken away from me. And if nothing can be taken away from me, there's nothing to fear. In this way, you could be the king and live according to the principle of simple living and high thinking. The Srimad Bhagavatam gives many stories of great renunciates, like Kardama Muni, like Narada Muni. But how many stories in the Srimad Bhagavatam are there of great kings, emperors, like Parikshit and Yudhisthira and Bishabdev and Bharat and Priyavrat and Ambarish and Dhruva Maharaj and Prahlad Maharaj, Maharaj Nimi? Most of the stories of Srimad Bhagavatam are about the pure devotion of great kings who had royal palaces, infinite prestige, tremendous amount of influence over others, wonderful family members, and it's describing how they lived simple living and high thinking. They were the simplest of all creatures on earth. Why? Because in their hearts they claim proprietorship over nothing. Simple living and high thinking means you could either live on a little plot of land with a cow and a few grains growing and run and raise your family like that and just spend a good portion of your time having kirtan, reading from the shastras and associating with sadhus. That is simple living, high thinking. Living in the jungle or in a holy place like Vrindavan, Mathura, Ayodhya, Jagannath Puri, Dham, just living, performing tapasya, begging for japatis, madhukar. That is also spending all your time just hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord and the absolute bare maintenance of your body. That is also simple living and high thinking. But Bhagavatam also describes kings who are living in palaces with royal families and royal assemblies and fabulous wealth, and how they were living just as simple. The principle of simple living, high thinking was as much manifest in their lives as the sannyasis in the jungles. Why? Because renunciation doesn't simply mean not to have anything. Because there are poor people on the streets, beggars on the streets who are attached to their little blanket. And because they're attached to their little blanket, they're not living a simple life. They're living a very complicated life. They're constantly in fear that someone's going to steal their blanket, right? And amongst the other beggars, there's a sense of prestige that I have a better blanket than you. So simple living, high thinking, even if you're the poorest person, it doesn't necessarily mean you're like that. And even if you're the richest person, it doesn't mean you're not like that. Simple living, high thinking is a question of our consciousness. And this, the great Brahman learned from the python. He's simply content with whatever Krishna provides, knowing that everything is his. Therefore, he doesn't lament when he loses something, and he's not elated when he gains something. He's simply thinking, Krishna, I'm simply working on your behalf. And the great kings of the Bhagavat, that's how they lived. The most celebrated persons, setting the highest examples for all of us. That when you have nothing to lose. And when you have nothing to lose, you have nothing to fear. When you have nothing to fear, you're peaceful. There's no anxiety in life. You are in Vaikuntha. And the fact is, nothing is yours. The fact is you don't have anything to lose. And the fact is that you are in Vaikuntha. But you've forgotten due to material attachment. In this way, through these most insignificant and lowly creatures of the earth, Krishna is speaking the highest philosophy to each and every one of us. And by simply hearing their message, we will never be bewildered, but we will progressively march forward on the path back home, back to Godhead. Is there any questions? Yes.
Nothing belongs to us, and yet at the same time, nothing belongs to us, yet at the same time we possess something for Krishna's service and we have to protect it. And protection comes the fear of losing. So how are we?
You're not possessing it. You're simply... utilizing the facilities on behalf of Krishna. It is your duty to take care of what Krishna gives you. If you defend something for Krishna, That is not fear. Why is it not fear? Because you're not thinking in terms of losing your own sense gratification. Your thinking is in terms of devotion to the Lord and devotion to the devotees, devotion to Krishna. Therefore, that type of defending nourishes our Krishna consciousness. But if we're defending it for our sense gratification, then it simply diverts our mind away from Krishna consciousness. And you'll find when you're doing it for Krishna, you become fearless. But as soon as you start doing it for your sense gratification, you become very fearful. Huh? You'll find that if you're really and sincerely thinking, I'm defending this, I'm protecting this for Krishna, you become so fearless. But as soon as you start thinking of your own profit adoration distinction or your own physical or mental condition, immediately you become very fearful. Is there any other questions? Exactly how everything manifests, Krishna will reveal in time. Throughout history, this has always been the case. The battles between the demigods and the demons have been going on from the beginning of creation, correct? But the Lord always protects His devotees. Even in Satya Yuga, there were wars between the demigods and the demons. What to speak in Kali Yuga? But you see, in Kali Yuga, the general populace is so demoniac that as Kali Yuga gets more and more progressive, the devotees become so outnumbered. The devotees become so outnumbered that it is described towards the end of Kali Yuga, the devotees have to be just living in the forests. People will be hunting them to eat them. In that situation, they're in a helpless condition by their own efforts to protect themselves. All they can do is just chant the holy names. Huh? And at the end of Kali Yuga, because the devotees are in such a helpless condition, the Lord Himself responds to the chanting of their holy names and comes as Kalki Avatar, and He personally has to come and kill the demons. Huh? Which is practically the entire population of the earth. The demons become so powerful that the devotees don't stand a chance of defending themselves. They're simply depending on Krishna, and like always, Krishna always comes to save the day. Huh? In every circumstance, when we take shelter of Krishna, Krishna saves us. There's never a time when Krishna did not save his devotee, when his devotee called out for his help. How he saves his devotee, sometimes that may not be so easily understood by our physical eyes. But on a higher level, we can know for sure that Krishna never neglects the sincere call of his devotees. Huh? But in regard to your question of wars between religious and irreligious people, this is something that has always gone on and it will always go on. But you see, according to the modes of material nature, sometimes the demons are more powerful and sometimes the devotees are more powerful in the physical sense. Huh? when the modes of passion and ignorance are strongest within the atmosphere, the demons derive power from that. And godly people derive power from the mode of goodness. Huh? So the demigods and the demons, they would always be conflicting. It's when the mode of goodness was predominant, the demigods would win. Huh? When the modes of passion and ignorance were prominent, the demons would win. There's always this conflict. There's always this battle of the three modes of material nature within this world. But the devotees are factually the pure devotees of the Lord, who are beyond religion in the sense of artha, kama, dhamma, moksha. They are transcendental. They are beyond the modes of material nature. They are simply crying out for Krishna in all circumstances. For them, there's really no question of victory or defeat. They're always victorious in every situation of life. Huh? They're always successful. Because whatever happens, they're going back to Godhead. Huh?
So does this mean that it's Krishna's pastime that in order to glorify his pure devotee that he gets these politicians to worship his pure devotee? Is that the great man? Even after their persecution, they become even more powerful through their teachings.
Well, historically, wasn't Hiranyakashipu a politician? He was the king, wasn't he? How much he persecuted Prahlad? And the more he persecuted him in the end, the more Prahlad became glorious. Lord Jesus Christ, who was he persecuted by? He was sentenced to death by politicians, by the governor. And his persecution and execution is what made him so famous to the world for all time to come. The sign of Christianity is the cross, which means the persecution. And Haridas Thakur, was it not the government leaders that persecuted him? Even Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates, when Chankazi was persecuting them, that was a very serious matter. You cannot imagine how fearful those devotees must have been if they were not completely depending on the Lord. Because in those days, if you read historically, the Mughal emperors, they were so cruel to people who didn't follow, who were not following their religion. They were just, there was mass massacres. They threatened to massacre and imprison every one of the associates of Lord Chaitanya if they continued with Harinam Sankirtan. It was such a disturbance. And it was no joke, because all around them people were being murdered and imprisoned for life for just doing a little puja, what to speak of doing Harinam Sankirtan. And they came, they broke the murdanga, and they threatened, if we ever see this again. And they knew, and the devotees knew that these men are serious. Huh? But Lord Chaitanya said, no, no, you just keep going out. Just keep going out, don't worry about them. Krishna will protect you. And they went out, but they were very afraid. So then Lord Chaitanya decided, I'll take you out myself. And then he defeated the entire government and saved his devotees. So you see, devotees are always persecuted from time to time, but the Lord always comes to save his devotees if the devotees turn to him for shelter. That is his promise. He never breaks his promise in relationship to his devotees. He told Arjuna, Konteya pratijanihiname bhakta pranashyati. Arjuna, you declare it that I will always protect my devotee. Krishna says, I sometimes break my promise for the sake of service to my devotees, but I'll never tolerate seeing my devotee break his promise. Krishna broke his promise just so that Bhishma would not break his. Right? Krishna promised, I will not raise a weapon. Bhishma promised that I will force Krishna to raise a weapon. So what happened? Krishna raised his weapon. Just so that Bhishma would not lie. The word of his devotee is more priceless than his own word. That is why Krishna, throughout Bhagavad Gita, Krishna so many times said, I will protect my devotees. But then he told Arjuna, you declare it, you promise. Because if you promise before me, then everybody will know that I'll never allow that promise to be broken. And that promise was, Arjuna, you declare that my devotee will never perish. I will always be there to protect him. Huh? Devotee is one who cries out for Krishna. So we must have that confidence. And throughout history we see, even when devotees are in the most desperate and all odds against them, Krishna is always there. Huh? And this is how Krishna glorifies his devotee, by showing that the devotee never gives up his faith, never gives up his devotion or his loyalty to the Lord under any circumstance. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.